from the John Clare poem that serves as its epigraph, to the hopeful note about the saving of the orange-bellied parrot from extinction in the author acknowledgments at the novel's end, I was mesmerized by Richard Flanagan's The Sea of Waking Dreams, the Booker Award-winning author's latest book. It's hard not to agree with these words taken from the Sydney Morning Herald. What an astonishing book this is. This novel is a revelation and triumph from a writer demonstrating, yet again, the depths of his talent. At once timely and timeless, full of despair, but leavened by hope, angry and funny and sad and a bit magical, it's masterful. Richard Flanagan is my guest on this episode of The Literary Life. This program is excerpted from a live virtual Books and Books event. Richard was in Hobart, Tasmania, and I was speaking to him from Miami, Florida. Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm good, Mitch. It's good to be with you in Miami, even in this disembodied form. Although I feel I'm rejuvenating. I've already lost half a day. I feel ever more youthful every time I see
you. Well, you know, I was going to start off by wishing you a happy Bloomsday, but then I realized you had that yesterday, right?
Yeah, we're recovering from Bloomsday here, Mitch. But anyway, I'm happy to write it again.
So Richard is here, Richard is in Tasmania. But, you know, as I was getting on, Richard, somebody wrote in the chat that the day that they saw you read at Books and Books from the narrow road to the deep north was one of this person's highlights in his literary life. Just want you to know that.
Yeah, well, that's very sweet, Mitch. That's very kind. Thank you.
I remember that like it was just sort of yesterday, actually. And so much has happened since, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the you know, when you read those novels about the First War or the Second War, you suddenly sense this enormous time passing in months and a few short years. And that's exactly what happened with COVID. It is as if one epoch ended and another started, and relationships, sensibilities, mentalities, everything's fundamentally altered now. But in what ways, no one quite understands.
Yeah, I think this last year, I think we're all kind of emerging, and we don't know what that emergence is going to look like, I don't think. I think you're absolutely right.
No, and I think experience is incredibly localized too. You know, I have a daughter who's been living in Berlin, who we haven't been able to see for 2 years, and her experience is so different than what ours has been, as what my friends in America experience has been. And localized too, even in the sense that, you know, I'm on Tasmania. Our island was actually locked off from Australia for a year. Even Australians couldn't get in here, and everything became local and particular. People started relating to their worlds in a way that noticed more. I think that people took things less for granted than they had previously, and I sort of sense there's a new politics, a new social awareness, and these things, as always, will have both negative and positive connotations. But there is a new way of thinking about everything abroad now.
I think that's the. I think, you know, when all is said and done, I think that's the hidden silver lining, if there is one in all of this, is that, you know, we all began to understand how precious time is, and how important it is to have a sense of community, no matter where that community is. And ironically, not ironically, but I mean, those are some of the things that you very much capture in this new book, which The Living Sea of Waking Dreams, which is right here, a beautiful edition, which blew me away, Richard. I mean, I was just drawn into this in a way that I just was completely unexpecting. I'll tell you why, too, when we get into this a little bit, because what you were describing mirrors, believe it or not, a little bit of my own life in some strange way that we'll talk about, and I'd love to know what you think. But you set this against a different kind of, a different kind of natural Holocaust, and that was the fires that took place in Tasmania and in Australia, right?
Yeah, that's right. I began it. We had apocalyptic fires here in 2018, and they were a harbinger of that terrible black summer that mainland Australia then had in 2019. And I began the book amidst those fires, which similar to your fires on the West Coast, are sort of unprecedented and behave in completely new and different and terrible ways, and against which we no longer have defences, and it suddenly all the debates about climate change became academic, because that there was just the reality that everyone had to live with now as they fled their homes, as they abandoned towns, as they were forced to live as, you know, internal refugees in their own country. And I sketched the book out during the fires in Tasmania, and it became apparent that these would be repeated on a much larger scale the following summer in mainland Australia. And I actually had a draft of the book finished in order to rewrite it completely in real time over that terrible summer. Mm. It would be infused not with a journalistic sense of what happened, but more I just wanted to capture the strangeness of how we behave in these times of complete crisis and confusion, where we discover that all the things we thought were certain, all the verities, everything becomes fluid and molten, and nothing can be taken for granted, even time itself and even language, which is why in the book that even words no longer seem capable of holding meaning any longer. So I wanted to capture those sort of things, and it seemed to me the best way was to rewrite the entire book through that long summer, and just let it, the spirit of that fill every sentence.
Well, it was so beautifully done. I mean, the way the backdrop of that summer, whether it was done in the rewrite or whether some of it was what you first put forward, it's just there. It's not announced. You know, it's so subtly there until it eventually kind of takes over in some very significant ways. But, you know, I don't want to make the mistake that I've made in the past, asking a writer, you know, to sort of summarize a little bit their book. And I will not do that to you. But what I'm going to do a little bit is I'm going to try to summarize it a little bit. And then you tell me if it's a fair summarization. All right. So, you know, on the surface of The Living Sea of Waking Dreams, the plot or the action centers on a woman, an older woman, who's in the process of dying. And her three surviving children, they gather in Tasmania. It's in Hobart, right? Where they gather. And they decide that their mission is to keep her alive. But in the process, with the backdrop of all these raging wildfires, this novel quickly becomes a story of vanishing. So you begin to see things vanish. Nature vanishes, rainforests vanish, meaningful human interaction vanishes. And even we begin to see the social order vanishing. And then what's fascinating to me is the story, you know, I have to be very honest with you, Richard. You had so many animals in here that I had never heard of that my Google was working overtime. And it was educational. I started learning about certain things, including the orange-bellied parrot, which is in the process of vanishing. But the story of the orange-bellied parrot is what ultimately gives us hope in this novel. Would that be kind of a fair general kind of summarization, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to, living here, this island I live on, it's about the size, I can't think of an American state exactly, but it's about the size of Sri Lanka or Ireland. So it's actually reasonably large, but it is by virtue simply of its isolation, something of an ark. And animals, birds, plants, rainforests that vanished that long ago elsewhere in the world have survived here into the present. But I became aware over the last decade that I was living in this strange autumn of things, and all these marvels and wonders that were here had perhaps another 10 or 20 years. Just across the road from where I'm talking to you are the last of the swift parrots, the fastest parrot in the world. It's like a little green missile shooting past you sometimes. A few bays round from here are the last 80 handfish, an ancient fish that crawls through the sand on its little front fins. You know, they'll be gone in 20 years. These things I always found very moving, and I suddenly realised they wouldn't be here for my grandchildren. And this will sound odd, but I wanted to write the book in a spirit of kindness and gratitude for the beauty of the world, because I think we have a terror of death precisely because we spend so much of our lives never living, never seeing the world just in front of us. And perhaps this goes back to your point that COVID made us see things again, let's value things again. And perhaps that's the unexpected gift of that awful, awful pandemic. The book's not written to promote any sort of position. It is just about the reality that we live in now. And I think fundamental to that reality is hope. It mattered to me that the book ultimately is about hope, not in any sentimental or mawkish way, but because I think hope is the essence of what we are. To despair is completely rational. And there's a lot of despair around at the moment. But to hope is the essence of what it is to be human. And I think if you want to write about things that are dark, you have to allow for hope, because even at the darkest moments, that's when people tell the best jokes. It's when they laugh the most. It's when they see the possibility for tomorrow. That's how we survive as a species. That's how we go on. And so I think if you're writing about these things, if you don't encompass hope, you've actually created something that's fundamentally untrue to what we are as human beings. So the description you gave is completely true, but at the heart of it, I wanted to write a book about kindness and gratitude, about beauty, which I think is a form of truth, but that's that truth itself is a form of beauty. These are very old ideas and they're unfashionable, but I think they're sort of helpful in the moment we've arrived at. And above all, I think, you know, I didn't consciously set out for it to end with ideas of hope, but that's where the story naturally led me to.
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, the whole tragicomedy nature of this book and the sense of humanity that is infused through it, you know, was something that, you know, was so cathartic for me going through, you know, what we've all gone through. And it was, you know, I realize it's kind of why I read fiction to a large extent. You know, I read fiction in order to live other lives and learn something through my own reaction to those other lives. And you took us right there. It was so, so poignant. I have to tell you a personal story, which you're going to, you know, we've never talked about this. So it's kind of, I think it'll be somewhat new. It's It was amazing when I read it. So my father, right? I had a 91-year-old father who died right before COVID, okay? And I was the primary caregiver. And I come from a family of four. So it was very similar to your, you know, to the family, but this was my father that I was dealing with. Like Francie in your story, my father's mind was perfectly there during all of the period that I was the caregiver. I'm the eldest in the family. So I guess about 7 years before he died, he developed what seemed to be Parkinson's. And then people thought it was Alzheimer's. And he was kind of fading away. And we finally went to this really interesting neurologist who said, wait a minute, let him, you know, walk a little bit. They diagnosed him within 3 minutes that he had what we call here normal pressure hydrocephalus, which is exactly what Francie had, right? So he was cured of that, and I was the caregiver, and my sisters and brother would come in, and we'd talk about it, and there was a question of whether to operate on him or not operate on him, but the idea was to give him, you know, he could get a good life if he had it. So that was taken care of. He was cured of that. And then about 2 years later, he started suffering from something else, and he had lymphoma. So, and he was cured at the age of 88 of lymphoma. He was actually cured of it. And so when I read, and for those of you out there, you need to know that this is how it opens with what Francie goes through. So you can only imagine how I was drawn into this, right? So you were touching on something that I think people my age, I know you're younger than I am, but people my age are going through in a very, very significant way, dealing with the whole notion of death of our parents and how to deal with it. And what that means for us as we become older as well. And these are issues that you dealt with in the book that I thought was, as I read further into it, I realized that that wasn't necessarily the main thrust of the novel, but it was for me an extra special kind of sideline to what you wrote about.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're confronted with something now that's very new in the history of human beings, and that is to die of old age. I mean, to die of old age was up until the last half century a rarity, really, you know, certainly up till about 1940. People didn't die of old age. They were pretty much gone by their mid-60s, if they were lucky. It's a very strange moment we're living in, where the children have reached middle or even old age, and their parents are still alive in extreme old age. With the medical capabilities that diseases, even at that point, can be cured. And I think we live still with an older style of thinking that when someone gets ill, they die immediately. And so it's confounding and confusing and difficult for everybody. But I was glad you used the term tragicomedy, because that's the sort of spirit the book's written in, because I think that's the spirit in which we live much of our lives. And when you are confronted with the possibility of death, with dying, it is both tragic and comic always at the same time. And to deny either is to deny what we are as human beings. And so it was very important for me to have these comic elements.
Francie's the extenuating circumstance of her death, it's like I was ready to sneak into the pages of your novel and put a pillow over her head. It was like, all right, let the poor woman die already. I mean, it was really, it became something, you know, not farcical, but it became something really like, all right, how selfish can you guys be to not let this poor woman sort of alone in that sense? You have a wonderful line in the book. And, you know, when I think about dealing with my dad, this is the question that I kept asking. And you pose this question: is living always preferable to dying, right? And so every decision that I kind of looked at my dad and said, are we going to do a medical procedure? Does this make his living better than dying? Do you know what I mean? And I kind of wished that that Anna and Terzo would have asked that question and answered it a little bit differently as well.
Well, there's a point in the story where the sun has gone down, but they refuse to accept both what Francie wants, because she has the wisdom and insight, despite all her infirmities, to understand that there is no longer a life worth living. And one of the problems we have now is that we condemn people not to living, but to a living death. And where that line is drawn, of course, is very hard to say. And who draws it's hard to say. But in this book, Francie is clear what she wants, and it's denied her by her children, and it's denied her by her children because it offends their vanities. It offends their sense of complete control over their lives, their sense that their bodies are theirs to order around, and by extension, their mother's body also. I think that's something else that COVID has taught us, that we aren't omnipotent, that, that there are always forces out there that are greater than us, that there is an anarchy in life, and we are better sometimes to go along with it rather than pretend it doesn't exist.
Richard, is it fair to say that that construct of the family you used, it's kind of a metaphor for the way we treat nature in essence as well? The fact that we exploit nature for our own vanity and the sake of, you know, you look at Terzo and what he represents, you know, representing kind of, capitalism run amok, and, you know, this whole sense of how we treat others. Because you say somewhere, and I think when you're talking about Anna, you say, Anna sometimes felt that to inflict such torment on a sentient creature in any other sphere of life would be considered criminally psychopathic and merit heavy punishment, right? And you mentioned creature, which could represent anything in the natural world, really.
Well,
maybe I'm stretching.
No. There's several aspects. I don't try and write metaphors. I'm no longer.
No, I know. I.
What they are. No. I'm not being cute about it. But what intrigued me is how we've now become obsessed about prolonging our own individual lives, and we're completely autistic.
Exactly.
To the widespread death of
everything around
life around us, that actually supports life and it supports our lives, and it seems that these things, far from being metaphorical, are very real and closely connected. This complete denial and refusal to see, this this death we're spreading everywhere. Throughout our oceans, throughout our lands, throughout our waters, there is nothing we're not killing at this moment. And our response to it is this determined attempt to merely prolong our own lives, as somehow that will vindicate our world, our purpose, and our sense of ourselves as not being the arch destroyers. So I feel it to be a realistic portrayal rather than a metaphorical one.
I strike the word metaphor. I accept what you say completely is what I was trying to say. And that is really the way I felt about it. I mean, it's more than a metaphor. Because what you do is you have the characters, you know, I mean, you have one of the characters start disappearing, vanishing, right? So Anna begins to vanish the way the natural world vanishes. So it isn't really a metaphor. It is they are, and we are in the natural world, and yet we seem so apart from it in the way we act, right?
The very phrase natural world is a really strange one, you know. Everything we are and do is part of the natural world. Our great cities, our great technologies are just as much a part of the natural world as a termite mound, you know. There's a distinction we and our hubris and vanity have drawn between us and all other living things to allow us to get to this point of possible catastrophe that we're now entering. In a sense, the book, you know, suggests that perhaps those lines, those demarcations are what are actually destroying us. And if we could just reconceive of ourselves. And I liked your point that you go to novels to live other lives. I've always thought that there's only one defence the novel needs to make, and that is that when you go to them, you discover you're not alone. And not only are there millions of other lives of people, there are millions of other lives of trees, birds, animals. You know, these things also, you know, novels remind us that we also live in them and they in us, you know, and that is the... I actually feel when you write novels that although you're writing an entertainment, and it must be a good entertainment and hopefully a very good one, but you do enter a large tradition that's also intellectual, aesthetic and spiritual, and it asks questions of us that we don't have any other form that asks the similar that asks those questions that philosophy doesn't, that science doesn't, that psychology doesn't. And the novel does ask questions of us as human beings that are necessary to us and that help us. And it just always intrigues me how its reports of its imminent death are always around us, and yet as other cultural forms come and go, the novel continues. But it's almost as if now it's become almost an underground culture, but a very powerful one. And it continues to ask the necessary questions.
Yeah, you. I think it's in the novel. You say, shouldn't stories work towards something that we can't get anywhere else, right? I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Yeah.
The other thing I saw or I read somewhere, which I thought was really, really interesting for me as a reader, is how you as a writer, how you view story and character. You view them as tools, right? More than anything else. Could that be right?
Yeah, I hope I'm not boring people. I've repetitious with these things, but
Not at all. I mean, I think of myself as every man. So if you're not boring me, you're okay.
Okay. Well, I'm every writer. I think the more, you know, I always notice, particularly in America, there's a very strong emphasis on story and character as as being the nub of what novels are about. But as I've grown older, I more and more think that the story and character are just the motley writers throw over more subterranean emotions they carry within them. And story and character are what they use to communicate those to the reader. But ultimately, it's not about these people and what they do. It is something much more abstract. I mean, I've forgotten who it was who said that literature aspires to the condition of music. I don't believe that's the case. I believe it is like music, and it is like humour in that it is ultimately abstract. And the what is being conveyed emotions and sensibilities that exist beyond the realm of language. And that's the paradox for any writer. You know, that's the there's that extraordinary moment in Madame Bovary where Flaubert steps out of character and says, why is it none of us can ever express the exact measure of all our thoughts and needs and sorrows and loves, and all human speech is like a cracked kettle upon which we tap crude rhythms for bears to dance to, when all the time we long to move the stars to pity. And that's the paradox every writer labours under. They want to move the stars to pity, but they tap crude rhythms for bears to dance to. And yet somewhere in that huge abyss between that ambition to move the stars to pity and that failure of tapping crude rhythms on a kettle, somewhere in there is what the reader discovers in the book. And that is these abstracted emotions that become very important to them. And in that, they discover, as you said, all the other lives, all the other possibilities of what it is to be human.
So well put. I mean, my experience of reading this book was, you know, just something that literally took me down different rabbit holes. So I learned all about marsupials that were being, that were disappearing. You know, as I said before, I learned about, you know, you had me, you know, you mentioned a Larkin poem. So I spent time looking up, you know, looking up the Larkin poem that you mentioned, finding it. I sent it out to my brothers and sisters and my immediate family, and everybody had a chat about it, which they hadn't, you know, been exposed to. In my own ignorance, I didn't know that poem, but it's a brilliant poem. And you even bring in 60s music, which I sort of, that, you know, with, you know, as much as I agree with you with everything having to do with Instagram, and, you know, at one point you say there's so much noise out there. The one good thing is that I can get online really quickly and look at a reference and then listen to it or read it or do something like that. That's the one good thing. But I agree with you completely with the whole notion that we become so broken in this world of, you know, this world of, we've become so disconnected from ourselves in so many ways that, you know, the fire, the pandemic, being alone, having to communicate with family, things we talked about earlier, I think has made many of us kind of rethink, you know, the time that we're spending. I know that I've unplugged, you know, more now than I did prior to the pandemic. And it's really important that we do that, I think.
The technology, it's, you know, technology obviously has many good uses, and I use it, I'm using it now, but it, what the book was concerned about was something else, and that's why it takes its title from a John Clare poem. John Clare was a peasant poet, for those who don't know him, and I'd imagine most people don't know him, from the early 19th century. And he's a wonderful poet, but he was born just on the southern side of the Fen Country in England, which was one of the last places in England to be enclosed. And enclosure was the practice that went on from the 1500s. Stealing the people's common lands, their forests, their moors, their lakes, their rivers, their pastures, which were shared in common and existed, in which people existed in an Indigenous relationship, a relationship we'd now associate with Indigenous people, where you shared the fruits of the forest and the rivers and the lakes, but they also had cultural and spiritual connotations that were very important. Where Clare grew up was the last area in England that hadn't been enclosed, and then in his lifetime it wasn't closed. That what was public property, what was shared property, became private property for the rich. And his poetry is both about the world that existed before and about the loss of that world. And in the epigraph, there's quotes a poem where he talks about how enclosure like a Bonaparte came and how the moles were hung like traitors. And there was a huge loss in that process. It impoverished people materially, and it impoverished them culturally and spiritually. And I feel what's happening now is the second great enclosure. But where the first enclosure stole all this commonwealth, these lands, the spiritual and cultural world, but it was an external world that was taken from people. We're now in a moment in history where what's being enclosed is an internal world, our souls, our hearts, our minds. And they're being stolen by the greatest corporations, the largest corporations the world has ever seen, utilising this technology simply for the purposes of greed. And in that, our fears, our passions, our loves, our likes, our hatreds, our madnesses, our fears, our depressions, our elations, these have all become another form of private property that's been stolen from us, or is in the process of being stolen from us. And this is a profound change in how we live and who we are. And it's one that we shouldn't be naive about, the enormity of the theft and the consequences of that theft for us. That's not an argument against technology, but it is an argument for how we presently allow technology to be used, and it's being used against us.
God, you know, it's so wonderfully put. Thank you for saying that. And thank you for including the Claire epigram. I that was another rabbit hole I went down. I started reading more of John Clare's poems, which, you know, reading about his life is phenomenally interesting. He was such an interesting guy.
He was an amazing fellow. And I was sort of really taken with the way that as his world started to be destroyed, this commonly shared world, and he, like us, he worked on the destruction for it. He took jobs as a labourer working on some of the damming of some of the wetlands because he needed the money, just like we all click on our phones and scan and scroll. But as it slowly went, his sense of identity went, and he was driven insane, ended up in an asylum for a few decades of his life. I've always found him an inspirational figure. His poetry, for me, reads in a very contemporary way, unlike his romantic compatriots like Keats and Shelley, you know, because he uses a demotic language, and it's much more approachable for us now than the more highly flown language of the other romantic poet. He has a lot to say to us now, I think.
He does. You know, this epigram was brilliant, and it flows so naturally into the rest of the book as well. I'm tempted to ask you to read that poem or that little snippet if you have the book near you. If not, I fully understand.
Yeah, no, of course. Interestingly, with this poem, it was only discovered, well, it was only published in the 70s, and it was published in some little monograph by some people who were Claire enthusiasts. So he references different places just around his local village, like Crosbury Way and Old Round Oak, which also feature in some of his other poems. To the acts of the spoiler and self-interest fell a prey, and Crosby Way and Old Round Oak's narrow lane, with its hollow trees like pulpits, I shall never see again. Enclosure like a Bonaparte, let not a thing remain. It levelled every bush and tree and levelled every hill, and hung the moles for traitors, the brook is running still. It runs a naked brook, cold and chill.
It's beautiful. It runs a naked brook, cold and chill. It's beautifully done. Thank you, Richard. Thank you for that. But this leads me to a broader question. And, you know, I know that you're so eloquent about your commentary and your thoughts on our contemporary world and politics and the role of the writer. Talk a little bit, about what you think the role of is there a responsibility that the writer has to the world around us in one way or another? And two, you know, as a fiction writer who also writes nonfiction, how do you keep those two parts separate in one way or another? What is, you know, how do you bifurcate that in your own mind?
Well, in terms of the responsibilities a writer's got, I think a writer should only be irresponsible, you know. But I think
good. That's great. I love that.
You know, like any writer that professes to be responsible.
Let's all be irresponsible together, right?
Yeah, that's great. Find them a rather dreary sort of reading. you know, because writing has to exist, or literature has to exist beyond morality and ethics and politics. You know, there's much being written at the moment how all art is political. It can't be, because all life isn't political. You know, the transactions of power are an aspect of life, but they're only an aspect of life. And they're the least interesting aspect of life. And in the end, politics is the enemy of love. And love is, you know, one of the highest expressions of what it is to live. So I feel that any sense to impose morality, responsibility, ethics upon writers is utterly misguided. I see no good arising from making those sort of cases. Your second point, how do I distinguish between journalism and nonfiction?
Yeah, how do you choose? How do you choose? You know, when do you choose, you know, how to approach your ideas in a sense?
Well, I feel I'm a novelist by choice and a journalist by misadventure.
That's great. I love that.
Out the front door and a mistake, you know. So with journalism, I think it's always a voyage outwards, and whatever you find out there, you must describe as accurately and truthfully as you can. And to the extent you gloss it, it should be clear what your gloss is and what your observations are, so that the reader's clear. So you put your hand in the wound and you describe the wound as best you can. The novels, though, are a journey in the opposite direction. They're a journey inward into your own soul. And that's always difficult. And most days you never reach there. But the rare occasions you do, you discover there all the things that you're not. You discover that you're not contained by your character or your history or your politics or your opinions, and that there is something larger that we share with others. And you write from that. And I always find that a more interesting place. Because journalism in the end is constrained by politics and history and opinion. It's a narrow field for me. The novels allow you to abandon yourself, and that always seems to me to be far more interesting. And the least interesting thing about a book is the writer, which is why most writers... most biographies of writers are such a bore. You know, that great American literato Elvis said, when I sing, I feel I'm touched by God. And you don't have to have a belief in the divine to know that Elvis was probably a pretty ordinary fella who could sing like an angel. And he understood that was the divine in him. And each of us has an aspect of the divine. A writer, if they're lucky, it expresses itself in their words. And, you know, we can say, you know, if we were Christian, we'd say it's God. If we're not Christian, and I'm not, it is something larger that we share with others. And it is that a novel is, and it's that the reader goes to a novel for.
Well, thank you for that. And I hope someday soon that we can, you know, reprise, you know, Miami for you. Come on down, sit and have a drink. I mean, I would love to. I could talk to you for hours and hours and days and days. This is the one good thing about Zoom or Crowdcast is that, you know, when would we ever be able to do this, you know, in another time where you're in Tasmania and I'm in Miami? It's kind of remarkable, actually.
It is remarkable. And, I mean, the sadness for me with COVID was, you people often ask me, because... You know, every writer writes about what they know. So I write about this island here. If I'd grown up in Miami, I'd write about Miami. But really, my homeland and my friends, I have friends around the world, and it's been a great sadness for me that I can't see them, that I can't, because there was such a joy. And I had so many, I hope I still do have after these missing years, so many, you know, friends in the book world.
You do.
And I miss them, you know. And I hope this ends soon, and we can travel again and see.
Well, I look forward to it. I look forward to breaking bread with you and sitting down with you. And I know booksellers and readers all across this country would like that as well. The book is The Living Sea of Waking Dreams.